I'm David Schreiner Kahn, and this is Smashing the Plateau. No matter how successful you are, there's probably at least one area where roadblocks are keeping you from fully achieving your goals. Fortunately, you've come to the right place. Every expert I interview on this podcast is different, but they all have one thing in common. They know how to fix problems that keep people stuck. Today, I'm pleased to welcome Marilyn King. Marilyn is a two-time Olympian in the grueling five-event pentathlon. Her 20-year athletic career includes five national titles and a world record. An automobile accident in 1979 rendered her unable to train physically for her third Olympic team. Using only mental training techniques, she placed second at the Olympic trials for the 1980 Moscow Games. This extraordinary experience and the resulting research led to a 30-year career as an expert in the field of exceptional human performance. Marilyn's work is a powerful example of applying skills learned through sports to three specific areas: business, education, and peace. Marilyn's work includes programs conducted for senior executives at Fortune 500 companies such as AT&T, Apple Computer, Hewlett-Packard, IBM, IKEA, Microsoft, Nokia, Oracle, Swiss Reinsurance, Starbucks, and Wells Fargo. Marilyn has been featured on Forbes.com, The NewsHour with Jim Lehrer, and NBC Nightly News. Marilyn is also involved in a joint Russian-American venture called the Peace Team, resulting in two opportunities to speak at the United Nations. Marilyn, welcome to the show. It's so great to have you on. You have such a great career, and I'm really looking forward to this discussion.
Yeah, me too, David. I'm delighted to be here, and I really appreciate your interest. It's an exciting time kind of to be alive and awake on the planet, so I'm delighted.
Yeah, it certainly is. It certainly is an exciting time to be alive and awake on the planet. I know we were just talking before we started the recording about what an exciting time it is to be a leader in the world. And yes. And I wondered if we could start off by talking about trigger events, because they often impact our not only our career path, but also how we behave as leaders. And I know you had a huge trigger event, as I mentioned in the introduction, your accident in 1979, and I know it impacted much of the rest of your life. I wondered if we could start by talking about that, how that impacted you, and a little bit about what the results were.
Yeah, and I think it is helpful for people. I call myself an accidental Olympian. Being relatively shy and moving all the time, I found that sports was a good way to meet people. And then they didn't have enough competitors for the Eastern States Pentathlon, so I volunteered. And at the end of the day, I was the third best on the whole East Coast. And, you know, just all of these things just kind of unfolded. It was, you know, an accident that I followed up with action. But at a certain point, you know, there's this pivotal moment where they invite someone I had beaten to go to the Olympic training camp. And it's like, wait a minute, I'm better than she is. That means I could go to the Olympics. So that fueled me through two Olympic teams. But what you're referring to that was so pivotal in the shift to this post-Olympic career was that in training for my third Olympic team, I had decided that I would have one last year in which, for the first time, I could just physically train. Took a year's leave of absence from my coaching position at UC Berkeley, put my money in the bank. You know, just going to do what the Russians and the East Germans did, which is have 24/7 to train all the way up to 1980. And yeah, my car was hit from behind by a truck and wound up with a misdiagnosed bulging disc in my back that pushed on a nerve and didn't allow me to do the 6 to 8 hours a day of training that I'd done for, you know, over a decade at that point. And because I thought it was only temporary, I kept thinking it's not a problem. It's a tweak. I'll be in the top three at the Olympic trials. I'm getting better every day. And what can I do today? So physical therapy, once a couple of weeks go by of that, nothing's happening. It's like, wow, I've got to really do more than this. So I got films of the world record holders in all five of my events. And I thought, well, I'll watch movies of the best. Frame by frame, slow motion, close my eyes, practice it in my mind. I'm thinking I'm doing this for a couple of weeks. Well, it goes on for like 6-7 weeks, and now I'm really bored with these films. And so I figure, well, shoot, I'll go stand on the track. I'll be better next week, and I'll be in the top three at the Olympic trials, but I need to do something. So I would stand on the track for 3 half-hour hours and just envisioning my training or my competition. And then, if we fast forward 7 months, you know, I hadn't been able to physically train. I had a Novocaine injection in my back so I could compete in the Olympic trials for the 1980 Moscow Games. And I beat everybody but one person in this country. I placed second at the Olympic trials in 1980 without physical training for almost 7 months in the five-event pentathlon.
Now, did you have any training at all right before the game started?
Physical training?
Yes.
Zero.
It's really remarkable.
It's like unbelievable.
I know I read this about you, and I know we talked briefly about this before we started the recording, but I'm listening to this, I'm thinking, how is this possible?
That was a pivotal turning point in my life that pushed me to ask questions about exceptional human performance, the answers to which, you know, wound up equaling what I now call Olympian thinking, that says there are always three things present. When people do something they're not supposed to be able to do, or push the upper levels of their ability, or succeed at a high level over a long period of time, three things are always present. And it's passion-powered. It's not a shoulda or supposed to or have to. This person is hugely invested in this for some reason and is connected to it every day. They think like the kinds of things I learned about imagery and visualization. So that's kind of where the art and science lie. And then they follow it up with really effective strategic daily practices. They've got a game plan. They've got daily practices. They've got feedback on those daily practices. But, you know, it's the alignment of passion-powered, vision-guided, and action-oriented. So that's what I discovered out of the pivotal experience in training for 1980.
And the strategic daily practices, I'm assuming, are not, it's not just strategic thinking, but it's really taking action in a very methodical way.
Yes, and I would, in the work that I do, I actually talk with people and ask them to take a look at, you know, what is your most important daily practice? And all of a sudden they start to realize, oh, well, there's the physical practices like brushing my teeth or, you know, going out for a walk in nature or meditate, whatever it might be. Right? So there are physical practices, and you it would be good to be really clear about what the most important, most effective, and make sure that you're supported in doing that to maintain your physical health and well-being. But then there are the mental practices, and that's, you know, a lot where Olympians separate themselves from other people. Olympians don't wake up Monday morning and go, oh, crap, you know, it's Monday and I need to and rah, rah, rah. You know, Michael Phelps woke up and went, geez, you know, 8 gold medals, you know, what am I doing today? You know, and he was on fire to figure out how to be more effective and what he could do today to win 8 gold medals. So there are mental practices, and some of them lead you down a road that is less effective and inhibits your progress. And there are others that are extremely helpful and useful and strategic that will accelerate your ability to achieve what you care about. And then there are the, you know, we're talking about physical practices, mental practices. When I talk about passion, you know, that's about the human spirit. When I woke up in the morning, all I did was imagine walking into the Olympic Stadium with a USA uniform the first time. And I would just fly out of bed and go run around the lake and run up and down stadium steps and do all this stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that was like the human spirit. Well, now as someone who's no longer training for an Olympics, you know, that place for me is deeply spiritual. That level of motivation comes from something that's, you know, not like an external motivational aspirational thing, but something that is, you know, for me deeper than that. But it really is about body, mind, and spirit. You know, either the human spirit or however you understand that deep level of motivation, you know, where that springs from for you.
Marilyn, do you think that it is common for business leaders to have elements of all three of these elements that you talked about?
The answer to your question for me has two parts, David.
Uh-huh.
One is that my experience, because now I've been, you know, learning about this, talking about this, teaching about this, developing tools to assist people in engaging this for 30 years. So I've learned a lot from a lot of people. And one of the things that became really clear to me is if you look at passion, vision, action, which I call Olympian thinking, and you say, well, yeah, there are times in my life in which I was like on fire. And how I thought about it was always new ideas and figuring out how to do it better. And, you know, every day I was willing to do so. You can really recognize moments or times or chapters. I believe it's also true that in any moment, you know, in any day, in any year, any chapter of your life that you look at, you can see, oh, you know, in my personal relationships, you know, I really cared and thought about it a lot, but I didn't really do very much to maintain what needed to be maintained to have a really high performance, healthy relationship. Or maybe I had that in my relationship, but it not really in my work or business, or in my commitment to community, or whatever it might be. So my point here is that I believe that there are chapters in our lives in which we can see it kind of writ large. But I also believe that in our life at any moment, if you look in the different domains of your life, you will see if all three things are operative, or if maybe only one or two of them are operative in areas that you actually care about. So I think that's true, what I just said, about everybody. But it's true for leaders also. But specifically about leaders, this is a place where I can get very excited. So reel me in if I go off, you know, too far into the stratosphere. But I'm very excited about the ability to make what I have discovered available to aspiring and senior leaders. Because right now, my belief is that right now on the planet is a pretty exciting time. And that relative to Olympian thinking, I think that in general on the planet, we've got two out of three things that most people really want to live in a world that works, right? And they want their company to work. They want their community. So the desire is there. And I believe in the action domain that people are willing to do their part and would even do more if they really believed it would make a difference. But they really don't know what to do in such a way. They know things that they could do that might help. But in terms of seeing a role that would really make a difference, they've got in the vision domain what I call stinking thinking. Oh, well, my company, you know, people are resistant to change, and this is a big old, you know, I work in this multinational, blah, 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 and you can't get, you know, they have all of this, you know, crappy thinking.
Right. Trying to make changes in my company is trying to turn a battleship around.
Right. And if that's what you think, that's exactly what it's going to be like. But what's also true is there are moments in which people change, shift on a dime. And we actually, those of us who have thought about these things, understand what the conditions are when people change on a dime. Because it's true. Sometimes it takes a long time. Some people are resistant. But also sometimes people change on a dime. So for me, coming back to your question about leadership, I believe that it's really a unique responsibility of leaders right now to make sure all three things are present in their workforce. And what I mean by that is if I'm a leader in the passion domain, if I've got people who come to work thinking, you know, oh, crap, you know, blah, 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 and rah, 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 and so I'm just going to keep my head down or, you know, just whatever it is, that's not high-performance thinking. And if you've got an organization or team filled with people like that, you will not thrive and you might not even survive. So I believe my job as a leader is to tell what I call a story of now, which helps people in my organization see why it was exciting then, where we are now, the best we know about the future, and here's what we're up to. And, you know, why one would be excited about that. So telling a story of now that demystifies what's going on and has people excited about being part of the next generation, the next iteration, the next evolution of this company, of this industry, of this planet, of this category, whatever it is. So I believe that's my job. There's no one else's job in the business, in the company, to do that, but someone who's a leader, to tell a well-informed and compelling story of now. That's number one. There are three things. Number two is I have to mine the collective wisdom of my organization. I can't figure out what the new gold standard is. I don't know what's happening at every level of the supply chain and out where the customers are and internal structures that allow for creativity and things that stifle, you know, just all that. I have to mine the collective wisdom. So in the vision domain, for me, it's about I need to create the structures within my business that mine the collective wisdom of the people who are in my company to create the new gold standard, to recognize why we're strong and good and what we need to bring forward of what we've always been, to leave some things behind and know what they are, but also to take on some new things and decide what's our strategy around this system of changes, this ongoing learning process, and to engage people in being part of that way forward. So for me, as a leader, you know, what's the compelling story of now? What's the new gold standard? And what do I have to do as a leader in terms of structures for daily practice so that when people show up at work, even if they were stressed at home, they walk in and they see something and they feel something they would want to be part of. And they know exactly what their role is. And they know how to give feedback and to give feedback to others. And they feel that they will be recognized for their contribution to this exciting future. So for me, that's really kind of the short version of how I see the implications of Olympian thinking for who leaders are. And by the way, if you're a senior leader, it's a different kind of challenging. There are things that you have to let go. If you're an aspiring leader, there are some structural obstacles and things that you have to learn how to deal with so that these changes can happen. So Well, if I'm an aspiring leader, it's like we know that there are these entrenched ways of being and people who sacrificed and worked hard to get where they are. And so it's more difficult for them to let go of power and to allow for the creativity of the organization to have them not just look like the smartest guy on the planet. So when you're a senior leader, there are different changes that you have to make to allow for this wisdom within your organization to fulfill the promise that your organization can be. If you're an aspiring leader, you have to know that there are these entrenched, stuck ways, and you have to understand systemic change.
Do you think it's hard for people who have a particular technical training or professional skill set training to understand the nuances that you've just described that will enable them to be successful, particularly if they're aspiring leaders? So they're shifting from a role that's primarily one of performing daily action and performing tasks around a skill set to moving into a place where they are telling that compelling story, the story of now, and they are becoming responsible for inspiring other people to act.
Yeah, I think I would say I agree with you that these are very different things. If there are some people who just really want to be in there in the whatever the specificity is. Look, this is what I'm really good at. I am genius at, you know, how to put these particular pieces together in a new way that fulfills this desire for this product. And that's what I'm good at. I don't want to deal with people. I don't want to deal with systems change. This is where my gift is.
Right. I'm a programmer. I want to program.
Yeah.
Or I'm a plumber. I want to fix pipes.
Yep. And at the same time, my hope, and there are reasons why I see that this is actually occurring, and I believe will accelerate in its occurrence, which is that we understand at least that we no longer should be training people just to be that specific nut or bolt in the machine. That our young people all need to be lifelong learners and know they're not going to learn how to shoe a horse and that's what you do for the rest of your life, and if you get really good at it, everybody will come to you. You know, that you're going to change jobs a lot of times, that you are part of complex and larger systems, and that you have a role to play in whether that system perpetuates itself or whether it changes. So this is kind of a long-winded way of saying that I think that there is an understanding and there are some places where people are actually implementing ways of educating young people, not to be a cog in the wheel only, but to also see, it's like, you know, one of the people I love is, you know, Edward de Bono. And he just, you know, teaching six thinking hats. And so, I mean, I was able to teach my inner city kids, you know, thinking skills and learning styles, and they came to understand that you had to be street smart in order to get home safe through some streets in Oakland. But you could also have your goofy hat on in the hallway and, you know, being the guy who makes everybody laugh. But when you walk through the classroom door, you have to take that hat off and put on your good student hat if you actually do want to go to college. And then you can take that off again. So my point here is that I believe that we are in the beginnings of, because we've known for a while, there are people who really don't want to be in that leadership position. It's too complex. It's a moving target. I have to stay on top of it all the time. It's actually easier in some ways to become a master at this particular aspect of coding or something. But there are people who aspire to be pioneering, to then bring back things that they have found and share it with others in a way that they can then be creative and more knowledgeable and more effective in what they're going to do.
I'm wondering, also, at the outset, we talked a little bit about the current time period being a really exciting one for the kind of work that you're involved in, the kind of thinking that you've been doing for the last 30 years. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about why this time is so exciting and what's different about this time than perhaps when you started your career.
Yeah. Number one, we can communicate what we know. I mean, valuable information can move very quickly. One reason why it's different is if you have something of value to offer, you know, there are ways that you can find to make it available to people who are hungry for it.
That's really true. That's true.
Yeah.
The information moves very fast.
Yeah. The other thing that's true is if you look once again at the passion, vision, action framework, I think that there is a heightened desire. I think that one, people are more scared in terms of the viability of the future for their grandchildren because they now get it, that things that happen in China matter and things that happen in other parts of the world and what companies do, all these things actually do with all these things are connected. So I think that people are more concerned and therefore more motivated and wanting to do their part and know what they can do so that the world actually can fulfill the promise that we are. So I think there's a heightened desire, but still the thinking lags behind the willingness to act. So that's why the leadership thing is so important. And, you know, not to get into politics, but just speaking from a perspective of, you know, vision, it's one of the things I liked about Bill Clinton. And to this day, whenever he's asked about something in an interview, he'll give you a 2 or 3 minute, like, snap course in the history of what you're asking about, and then talk about solutions that have been tried, things that are going on now, and what he's most hopeful for and what he thinks we should be doing. And you have a very different, you know, so to me, that's leadership. And that's why the story of now, you know, so for us to assist our leaders in having the kind of time and access to resources and information and people in other domains so that they can create a well-informed and compelling story of now that really does inspire their people. So to me, you know, when people have that, it's like, oh, you mean that if I recycle all of this stuff that I used to throw in my trash, that it will go over here and save that and do that? Oh, I can do that. And then when you get information back that the people of Oakland, you know, responded more quickly than almost any other city in the United States, that we overwhelmed the baby recycling program. They couldn't handle everything that we gave them. So I really believe that we're at a moment in time in which leadership is so important because we can create a story of now that says, you know what, we can make it. And there are people who have been working on aspects of what we need in order to make it, and they're more excited now than they were 20 years ago. You know, whatever it is you care about, there are people who have been working on that. You know, and here you can find things that you can do to make a difference. And I think it's important for us to, you know, provide accurate feedback to people so they can see it's like, wow, you know what? You know, here's some information. You know, I know we may wind up talking about people who I'm excited about right now. And one of whom is Hans Roesling, Roesling. And you look up GapMinder, GAPMinder.org. And he's providing information and statistics in such a way that makes a story that it really shifts people thinking and going, wow, I didn't know that. You know, maybe we really could make it. And you know, what can I do? And, oh, okay, you know, let me learn more about this. So inspiring people to get engaged instead of sitting back and saying, ain't it awful?
Well, it's both inspiring and hopeful, and certainly encourages me to want to sign up. So I'm hoping that works for our listeners, too. Marilyn, I wonder if you could shift a little bit and talk about what you're working on now.
Yeah, and I really thank you because in my athletic days, I was a pentathlete, and people didn't even know that word or know what that was about. But I was working on 5 separate events and was not the best at any of the 5. But when it came for pentathlon time, you know, I was in the top 3 in this country all the time. And so I feel like for the past number of decades, I've been working on 5 different events. You know, and we could call it, you know, peak performance and, you know, mobilizing Olympians worldwide and developing curriculum and discovering what the real status and trends and people who are working to accelerate the next evolution of peace. So I've become masterful, but not as masterful as the best in 5 different events. And it came together. Ted Turner invited 100 different career path people, you know, one from the U.S. and one from the Soviet Union, to come to something called the Citizen Summit. So you had a teacher from Russia and a teacher from this country, an astronaut from there, an astronaut from here, you know, a homemaker. And so there was an Olympian from Russia and me. And we wound up creating a joint project, which all of these other 99 teams did in their domain. And we called it the Peace Team. And so I've actually, well, people couldn't really understand what the heck I was doing, like the pentathlon. You know, the Peace Team is 5 different things. It says, you know what? We are mobilizing Olympians worldwide to deliver the message that if you apply your best thinking to peace, you change your behavior that changes the results. So we now have a worldwide alumni association that we can equip them to go out with the message and use music and the media to deliver the message that, you know what, we can make it. We can make it. And there's Olympian in each and every one of us. And, you know, join the peace team. Join the Olympian-inspired peace team. And all that means is, you know, you can't be poorly informed. If you're joining our team, whether it's a basketball team or a peace team or a business team, you know, you need to be well informed. You need to know what the goal is, you know, to know where we come from. Are we coming from a winning tradition? Or are we coming from the bottom? You know, you need to be well informed about everything you need to be informed of to be on our team. So what does that mean? If you're on the peace team, you can't have stinking thinking and be poorly informed about the history, the status, who's doing what, and what your role is. And then, you know, you need to have daily practices. What's your role? What are you doing today? What's your most important daily practice? And please, you know, put the score up, you know, let people know, you know, contribute to the number of people who volunteer in education in your community or whatever it might be. But, you know, my current work is really about mobilizing Olympians worldwide to deliver the message and encourage people to apply their best thinking to peace. And, you know, kind of the bottom line and of that is there's something called the International Day of Peace, which is September 21st every year. And it's gone from an idea and a declaration in 1983 at the United Nations to being celebrated in 153 countries around the world, but still kind of underutilized from my perspective that, you know, by 2020, I think Peace Day will be bigger than Mother's Day. And people will have it as an opportunity to be well informed by people like Hans Reusling at Gapminder, who's presenting information that allows people to see the light and see what's going on and see their own role and be excited in being part of, you know, this shift to the next evolution of peace in our lifetime.
Where do I sign up?
You know what? Here's the bottom line. You know, if there was never, you know, a website or an organization or a team or any of that kind of stuff, it really just means one thing. If there's one daily practice that I would recommend for people who already want to live in a world at peace and are willing to do something, but really, really not sure, you know, what they can do that would really matter. Here's the thing that to me just like turns the light on or just, you know, is the paradigm shift. I kind of, you know, dare you to imagine, or I'm encouraging, inviting you, you know, just take 10 days and wake up every morning kind of like Mike Phelps did, you know, when he woke up and said 8 gold medals. And because he started his day with that, he would have new thoughts that led to new behaviors. Or like Marilyn King did when she went from being just someone who was hoping to make friends to thinking, you know, holy moly, I could be in the Olympics. And every morning waking up with that gave me new thoughts of what I needed to do. Wake up every morning. If you want to be part of the peace team, just for 10 days, wake up every morning and think, you know, wow, we could see peace in my lifetime. And what happens is you start to ask a series of questions and enter into an exploration that will accelerate us winning the gold. We can move to the next evolution of peace much more quickly by applying Olympian thinking to how we think about the world we want to live in.
And working together.
That's right. That's right.
Marilyn, is there one person you might want to mention who is doing really remarkable work in the area of promoting peace?
Well, you know, he wouldn't talk about it this way. Well, one thing I would really recommend that people, and this is one of my greatest teachers and mentors who's no longer physically with us. His name is Willis Harman, H-A-R-M-A-N. And he was the president of the Institute of Noetic Science. And he came from a very left-brain science background, had this huge epiphany and became a futurist. And one of the things he said is, Marilyn, the negative belief that peace is not possible is the greatest impediment to achieving peace. If you don't think something is possible, you're probably not going to come up with the creative ideas and solutions. But when you believe that you could be in the Olympics, you come up with new ideas and you're willing to, you know, do anything. So Willis Harman's work from way back then, he talks about, you know, how to think about peace and be empowered to do something about it. You know, Francis Moore Lappay wrote about the five mental something like blocks that prevent us from the world that we want to live in. So there's a lot of literature out there, but I would say currently the most exciting and fun and easily accessible place to go is gapminder.org and watch the 200 years that changed the world. And you will see how much more quickly, you know, developing countries are moving toward, you know, the underpinnings of a sustainable society than, you know, any time in the history of the planet. So gapminder.org is presenting information to people in a way that, you know, has them, you know, really realize it's like, wow, I didn't know that. Well, that's really cool. Well, if that's true, then maybe we can make it. And it's the beginning of a new way of thinking that will allow people to really explore and be excited about being part of the peace team.
Well, Marilyn, this is a great point on which to at least end the discussion for now. And I wondered, before we close, if you could let listeners know how they can learn more about you and your remarkable work.
Thank you. So the best way is my website, www. And it's waybeyondsports.com, waybeyondsports, waybeyondsports.com.
Great. And we'll put that in the show notes. Marilyn, thank you so much for taking the time to join us today on Smashing the Plateau. My guest today has been Marilyn King, president of Beyond Sports, and so much more. Thank you again, Marilyn, for joining us.
You're welcome. We're obliterating the plateau.
I sure hope so. Thank you, Marilyn.
Yep. Thank you, David.
You've been listening to Smashing the Plateau, the podcast produced by 10 Strategic Partners. Be sure to visit our website at smashingtheplateau.com and join our email list to hear many more great interviews like this one. And if you like what you heard, please leave us a review on iTunes by going to smashingtheplateau.com/iTunes. I'm your host, David Schreiner-Kahn, and we'll be talking again soon.